The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
If we all turn into no impact man, woman, and child, but since it's going to take a while till we get there, we're going to find out about that journey, about that process. I am absolutely thrilled and honored to have as my guest for the entire hour on the Green Front today, Colin Bevan. He is an author, a filmmaker. He is my superhero. He is the ultimate creator of the ultimate eco experiment, and he has put his family and his life where his mouth is in beginning this experiment, I think about a year and a half to 2 years ago. We're going to find out all about what happened along the way. There is a fabulous book I highly recommend by the name No Impact Man, and also a movie, but I can tell you that he is a fabulous writer, so you should at least see read the book before you see the movie, but one or the other would be great because this is a very compelling story, a tale about life in modern America and the conflicts that we are presented with every day, since convenience clashes with conservation. You know, are we at fault? Are we a bunch of selfish, self-indulgent Americans, or is it just the machine, the modern way of life industry, the consumption disposal cycle that we all seem to be stuck in? Is there anything we can do? What should we be doing? Is it fulfilling to live a life with zero impact, or just frustrating and futile? We're going to answer all those questions with Colin Bevan. Thanks so much for being on the Green Front today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the beginning of this experiment. Your profession is as a writer, and that comes through from the first chapter of your book. You're a very I appreciate the humor. I had quite a few laugh out loud moments, and I just love your wry observation, your honesty, and of course the subject matter is very close to my green heart. But you weren't always this way. What were the early murmurings of your sense that something was wrong planetarily, your sort of ecological cognitive dissonance? I know from the book that the seeds were planted by your grandparents, but it seemed like that gene might have gone latent for a while. What made it manifest? What brought it out in your adult life?
Well, let's go back to, this is 2006 now. And,
oh, it's been 4 years. How has it taken me this long to get you on the program?
No, not 4 years since the experiment, but 4 years, you're asking me how it started. So
okay,
back
good.
In, so it kind of had its root in 2006.
Got
and
it.
I had just written a war book, and I was really very sensitive to the effects of war and what it does to people. And so when we went into the Iraq War, and the Iraq War was continuing, and we were having news like about Abu Ghraib, you know, the torture in Iraq and one thing or another, I was very sensitive and I was very depressed and worried about the war, which, you know, we kind of more or less know now that is really about oil. And so on the one hand, we had the oil. On the other hand, there was this news of global warming coming out. And I was walking down the street in January and seeing kids from the college dorm next to my house walking around in shorts and T-shirts in New York City in January, where we had had 70-degree day. So on the one hand, we were fighting for oil. And on the other hand, we were, you know, causing tremendous damage to the habitat that supports us by burning that oil. And then in between, we have this lifestyle. And what really started to worry me is that, you know, we're more or less, we're fighting for our lifestyle, we're wrecking the planet for our lifestyle, but are we really happy? And this is what really finally got to me, this, you know, that 27% of Americans are either suffering from anxiety disorder or depressed, and yet, you know, we're sacrificing so much. So I started to worry, might there be a way of life that's both better for us and better for the planet? And that's what started me on this quest.
And I love your psychological, sociological view of this. That's part of what has fascinated me covering this green beat for 12 years is, you know, how do we come to be this way? And how do we deal with the you know, what should be cultural cognitive dissonance, because we know on some level, don't we, that we are going down the wrong path. And most of all, how do parents deal with the fact that, you know, we fight so hard to make sure we can give our children the best health care, the best education, get them into the best colleges, and yet none of that's possible on a planet that won't support us. Is that dissonance growing? Is there enough signs of that? Or is it still just those of us, you know, sort of tuned into our environment that lay awake at night? And of course, we're going to get into what you did about it, and I can't wait to hear it. And that's why I'm thrilled to have you on for the entire program, because I have pages and pages of notes and questions and great quotes from your book.
Well, in terms of dissonance, you know, I don't think that the dissonance is just environmental. I mean, that is to say, I don't think that in order to be concerned about where we're going as a society, you necessarily have to be keyed into global warming or, you know, keyed into our environmental crises. I think that there are so many things that seem to be going awry at the moment that I do think that there's a general feeling like something's wrong. You know, we have the economic meltdown. Just at the moment, we have this, you know, this crisis in mortgages, where it turns out that banks have been throwing people out of their homes who have actually been paying their mortgage payments all along. There's all sorts of things that are beginning to worry people. And all of these problems are connected. The environmental problem, the economic problem, the quality of life problem are all connected by a way of life that's based on consumption. And so, yes, I think that the dissonance is increasing. And one measure I have of that is, you know, since the book and the film came out, I started a nonprofit project that helps people to learn how to live ways of life that are more environmental but also happier for them. And we've had, you know, closing down on 20,000 people participate in our programs, which means that, you know, people are really questioning and wondering, you know, what's the way of life we should lead moving forward.
A perfect example of the power of one. But before we get to the impact of your incredible journey, let's back up a little bit. I just happened to see the Inside Job documentary this past week, and I don't know if you've seen it, but it's all about how, you know, Wall Street really, it was an inside job in creating the mortgage meltdown. And in a sense, is our ecological decline partly an inside job? Meaning, is there anyone we can blame? Is it the corporations? Is it government? Is it perhaps like, you know, the question, who killed the electric car? It was a little bit of everybody and everything combined to bring us to this point.
You know, I think that blame is kind of it's a psychological response. Like, you know, we automatically want to figure out whose fault it is, because ultimately what we want to say, to be able to say to ourselves, is it's not our fault. You know, like we want to feel okay about ourselves. But it's not necessarily useful. The useful thing, I think, is actually to say, you know, what can we do moving forward? In fact, what can I do moving forward? So the question is, you know, who cares who's to blame? The real question is, what part can each of us play in the solution? And there's lots of ways to do that. Blame, you know, if we get into blame, then the next thing, you know, then what, it's ultimately a violent act and people reciprocate. The real question is, how can, instead of complaining about the bad, how can we add to the good?
And perhaps less damaging, but perhaps equally ineffective, is sitting around wringing our hands and wondering, you know, what can be done, just talking about our environmental path and what can I do and what difference can I possibly make as one individual. Well, it was those ponderings that got you to actually get off your you-know-what and say, I'm going to find out. That's a big step, because we all, many of us, you know, feel angst and feel, you know, vacillate between hope and futility on a lot of levels, but just talking about, you know, again, planetarily right now. What made you actually commit to doing basically what, if any of you have seen Super Size Me, kind of the same kind of experiment, only I think he ate junk food for about a month. You had zero impact or strive for that kind of impact and lifestyle for an entire year. I haven't gotten all the way through your book. I am going to finish it because I'm so enjoying it and I'm savoring it, and that's why it's not quite finished yet. So I don't know how it turned out, but tell us about the origin. You told us about what prompted it. What made you decide to take that step?
Well, so let's first take a step back and say what the step actually was, which was this, that with my little family, my wife, my then 18-month-old child, Isabella, and my dog, Frankie, we embarked on a year where we lived in as environmentally as possible in a ninth-floor apartment in the middle of Manhattan. And so that meant, and it worked in stages, and it meant first we figured out how not to make trash. And I don't mean how to make less trash or how to recycle better. I mean, we figured out as close as possible, which was pretty close, how not to make trash. And then we entered a phase where we also transported ourselves without causing any carbon emissions, which meant we only got around by biking or walking. And then we only ate local food produced within 250 miles, and then we went through stages of sustainable water use, not buying anything new, ultimately turning the electricity off in our house, in our apartment, because we couldn't find a way to get renewable electricity, and finally a giving back stage. So the idea was that we would reduce our negative impact on the one hand, and through volunteering to, say, clean up the riverbanks, trash off the riverbanks or plant trees, we would increase our positive impact. So the negative impact and positive impact, when you add them together, would make no net impact. Which technically, I mean, I'm sure you know, it doesn't really make sense in a scientific point of view, but the question was, can anybody live a life doing more good than harm?
And the first existential crisis in your experiment came when you woke up on day one and had to blow your nose and said, well, gee, I can't use Kleenex, can I? Or I think you ended up using paper towel and blowing
right.
your nose in a dead tree, as you said,
right.
and went from there.
Right. So you know, this wasn't an experiment where I, you know, I'm not an environmentalist. I didn't figure it all out ahead of time and just put into practice research I had already done because I wanted us to be like anybody else. You know, here we've just decided we're going to live as environmentally as possible. What happened? So, you know, day one started and I woke up in the morning with a runny nose and, you know, I just automatically opened the closet door to get a piece of paper towel to blow my nose, and there it was in my hand. I was like, I'm not supposed to use paper towel because it's both made from a dead tree and it creates trash, and what am I going to do? And then I kind of turned around, and my honking on my nose had woken up my little girl, who now needed her diaper changed. And I was like, oh no, plastic diaper. And then she was hungry, and I went to the fridge and opened the fridge and got out a carton of milk to pour and finished off the carton. And then I was holding this like empty, you know, cardboard container in my hand. So within 10 minutes of the thing started, I'd failed three times. But obviously, as we went along, we learned more and more and more. And you know, we replaced the paper towel with a handkerchief, replaced Isabella's plastic diapers with reusable cloth diapers, replaced the throw-away milk carton with reusable milk bottles, which sounds like a lot of work, but, I could tell you there were pleasures to each one of those things. Or, you know, for example, with the diapers, Isabella was old enough to tell us that she hated wearing plastic diapers. They were really uncomfortable, and also we're not sure what toxins are in plastic, so the cloth diapers were better for her. And by having the reusable milk containers, I actually developed a relationship with the dairy that I got my milk from, so that I was no longer buying from some faceless corporation, but actually had a relationship with the people that bought my food.
Before we go on, there's so much to talk about. Let's just drill down, if you will, on the subject of trees, since we talked about that with the paper towels. You have some great statistics in your book, sobering, really, how we go through 9 football fields of Amazon trees per minute. I believe that's globally. And then you have a great quote when you had your bagel crisis. You really wanted to stop at Bob's Bagels, but they wrap it in a piece of paper, so you had to deprive yourself. And you said, trees could help save us from ourselves if only we could just stop killing them all in order to wrap up our bagels. I mean, it's observations like that that just make this a really pleasant read as we go, you know, take this difficult journey with you. But I just love the way you've made it fun. Although I'm sure it was not fun while you were doing it at many points.
Well, no,
were you keeping
a
journal all the long, or did you do this all in reflection?
No, I kept a journal. I kept a journal the whole time. But, you know, it's to say that it's not, it's, you know, it's like any adventure, like climbing a mountain or any sort of adventure, you know, there's obviously hardships involved, but to say that it's not fun wouldn't be correct, because the thing about it is, the thing about living this year without environmental impact is that it was kind of, if you like, it was like a retreat from consumerdom, and it gave us, you know, it really was a chance for us to, even though there were hardships, like, well, you have to skip the bagel because it's wrapped in paper, it gave us a chance to really question what our lives are for, and to really, you know, to say, you know, if I'm going to be using resources, what am I going to use them for? And you know, now that I'm taking, if I'm going to take a break from, you know, if I can't have the bagel, well, because it's wrapped in paper, well, is that the most important thing in my life, or are there other things that are more important? And so it kind of gave us the opportunity to choose to live our lives intentionally. And so while it wasn't fun the whole time, it was important and fulfilling.
And speaking of that, going back to your grandparents and the way that they lived a much slower and satisfying life, and sitting down for dinner, as you talked about, and you didn't, not only did you not begin eating right away, but they wanted you to gaze out the window at the beautiful sunset, and I think you were, you know, silent for a couple of minutes before. And you talk about how that really, without even probably being aware of it as a child, was embracing, you know, the awe of nature and beauty of life and gratitude. So it wasn't, there are sort of less wasteful ways were not just about reducing garbage, but really more about gratitude. Say a little bit more about that, about appreciating what we've been given and not squandering it.
Well, you know, my grandparents, this was way before it was trendy to take, you know, you have a reusable bag. They didn't use reusable bags, but what they did was they saved their paper bags and took them back to the grocery store. And it was way before, you know, any environmentalist told us to do that. And the reason, I mean, I think part of it came from the fact that they had grown up during the Depression, and people during the Depression, you know, they didn't want to waste. But we tend to dismiss that sometimes. Like, yeah, they're Depression era, you know, they're attached to not having what they want and what they need, but actually there was something else about the way they lived that I thought was really interesting, and it was typified by what you said. Like, we sat down for dinner, and their windows looked out over the harbor, and the sun would be setting, and my grandmother would make us all sit quietly before we ate and watch the sunset, and what it was that it wasn't just that they were trying to miserly hold on to things. It was that they actually savored things. It's actually that when they had a paper bag, I think there was a level of gratitude for the fact that they'd been given that resource to use. And because they were grateful for it, they took care of it and didn't believe that it should be just be thrown away and turn around and get another one. So this was really interesting to me because, you know, in this throwaway economy that we have where we buy the same things over and over, you know, we buy a cell phone every 12 months, we buy a computer every 18 months, you know, we buy the same things over and over, you know, over and over and over again. And because we throw them away, I think that, you know, at least in my life, it led me to stop savoring them, to stop, you know, it's just something that's going to be thrown away. My friend, the writer Juliet Shore, I once complained to her. I said, you know, the problem with our society is that we're not spiritual enough. We're too material. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, actually, it's the other way around. We're not material enough. We don't see the divine in the material, so we treat it as though it should be thrown away. And
brilliant.
So what my grandparents kind of taught me, like, to see the divine in the material.
I must be from your family because I didn't have grandparents like that, or even necessarily, you know, eco-sensitive parents at all. I say I was born with this waste prevention gene, this extra Y chromosome or W chromosome, and if only more people were, or if only we could learn, you know, how to clone it in everybody, then we could close up shop. But isn't it kind of odd how some of us, and I'm not saying this in any kind of superior way because it's a real blessing and a curse, isn't it, to be sensitive to waste. Some of us just, you know, I have apoplectic fits when anyone in my family lets the water run, you know, from the faucet straight down to the drain without touching it for more than 5 seconds. I mean, I really start, you know, or screaming. And most people are oblivious. They say, I'm washing the dishes. And, you know, my brother who's staying with us will, you know, while he's loading the dishwasher, turn around and look at the TV while the water is going full blast down the drain. And I'm standing there going, ouch, it's almost as if someone is, you know, it sounds strange, but like scratching my soul. It just really goes against my grain. And what is that about some of us who are born this way?
Well, you know, I think it's important it's important to recognize that, you know, none of us have a monopoly on virtue. It's just where we point our virtue. And I remember one time I was on the phone with my dad, and I had done something that had hurt his feelings. It was during this no-impact year. And he said, you know, you should worry less about impact, whether you're impacting the planet, and worry more about your impact on your family. Mm-hmm. You know, what he was saying is, you know, you're all being like, you know, thinking you're so great. Not that I thought I was so great, but, you know, you're working for all this stuff, and yet, you know, you can be really selfish, which is true. And And so there's, you know, there are people out there who are taking care of orphans, or there are people out there who are just doing a really good job being loving towards their family. And then there's people like you and me who, you know, are concerned with waste and the environment. And I realize that it's not so much, you know, it's in my nature to be concerned about these things, right? So it doesn't make me virtuous. It was just like you said, kind of, I was born that way. So I like to think of it that way, because then we take away the element of good and bad and morality. It's not like there's us good people and those bad people out there. There's just people who prioritize one thing and people who prioritize the other thing. Now, it just so happens that we're in the midst of a number of environmental crises. Many of our environmental systems are in crisis. And that is to say, so for example, you know, as you know, the honeybee is having a hard time. And we need the honeybee because the honeybee pollinizes all our crops. If the honeybee goes extinct, we're in deep trouble in terms of creating our own food. So the habitat that actually supports us is in crisis. So it turns out it's not that the other people who don't think about the environment are bad, but it does turn out that we need to find ways to actually persuade more and more people to think about the environment and to think about our way of life, because we're in crises and because something has to be done about it now. But it's not about convincing bad people to be good. It's about convincing good people to turn their priorities in an urgent direction.
Absolutely. Just a very quick personal anecdote about how, you know, we can be sometimes a little short-sighted, or, you know, there can be some hypocrisy in our passion and good intentions. I was funding my own environmental radio shows for years, having started this a decade ago before it was supported by either corporate sponsors or mainstream media, which is still a challenge. But I literally, you know, bled our finances down to nothing trying to support my, you know, green radio career. And my husband pointed out that that was not sustainable, and I had to quit finally because, you know, I was so passionate about this that, and I knew the world would catch up any day now and then would get that return on investment. Hasn't quite happened yet, but, you know, that was a big aha moment. And also, you know, running around going to every green and climate conference in the country, and meantime my family's at home wondering where mom is, where's my wife, and my husband saying, you know, you can have a bigger impact on taking care of your family than you ever will have on the planet. So somewhere in the middle there. But let's get back to you, because you really did not take a middle-of-the-road approach. You really went full bore. So we're going to take a break in just a couple of minutes, and when we come back, talk a little bit more about your, you know, year and some of the challenges and the highlights, and then, of course, what has come out of it. But before we do go to a break, I just wanted to mention a couple of things that I really enjoyed. You know, you talk about how this lifestyle that we, you know, I guess, global citizens, but especially Americans, and again, we do have a disproportionate impact on resources, since we're, what, 5% of the world's population use about 25% of the resources, and that's everything from energy to food to water to minerals that we extract, lumber, et cetera, and create that much waste. You talk about how one of your insights was how we're in such a rush, you know, to, you know, be convenient, you know, get lunch to go, come back to our cubicles to work, to make money, to, you know, pay the nanny, to get our kids, you know, child care while we run to work to make money, and how we're so busy trying to, quote, something like getting the whole thing out of the way, and it's sort of like a snake eating its tail. That was a really kind of unique moment of elucidation, I thought. Tell us just a little bit more about that.
I mean, in our own lives, in before we did this No Impact Year, in our own lives, basically we would wake up in the morning. I would turn to Michelle and say, "Did you go to the grocery store?" And she would be like, "No, did you?" So there would be no food in the fridge, and so we would have to call the bagel guy, who would come and make a delivery and deliver food with all the packaging and also food that wasn't even really good for us.
Oh, my God. You mean they deliver bagels in New York?
Yes, they do. And
on bicycles, right? Or walking.
Yeah, sure. And so then we would hop out of bed, and then we would, you know, do what I call the box routine, you know, where you look at your box to see how much email you have, and then, you know, use another box to heat up things, and then, you know, veg out in front of another box, and then we would rush and take Isabella to the babysitter, and we'd both go to work, and then about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd have this phone call where we'd get on the phone call and, you know, "I'm stuck in work, I can't pick up Isabella, can you?" "Well, I have work to do too." And, you know, an argument about who's going to pick up Isabella because we're both so stressed about our work. And get this, the winner of the argument is the one who gets to stay in work late. Right? Not that the loser has to be with their own family. you know, and then come home and the whole thing over again, to take out dinner and love, until the point my little girl is like, well, I got to the point where she said, I'm hungry, Dad, call the man. And then she would see the delivery men going by on the street of New York, and she'd say, look, Dad, the man.
You know? Oh, gosh. And then there was a aha moment when you realized that the 46-inch elephant in the room was the embodiment of at least some of the evil, how you came to give away your television set and the impact of that. We're going to talk about that when we come back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to take a brief break. Colin Bevan, as I expected, it is just an absolute pleasure talking to you and thrilled to continue the conversation after the break. If you have not heard about Colin Bevan and his wacky experiment that turned out to be quite wise and certainly is spreading wisdom even today, a year and a half or so after he did it. The book and the movie are No Impact Man, The Adventures of a Guilty Liberal Who Attempts to Save the Planet and the Discoveries He Makes About Himself and Our Way of Life in the Process. We'll be back with Colin Bevan in just a moment. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. This is The Green Front. We report on what is new on the Green Front lines, and even though it's not brand new, you've probably heard about Colin Bevan and No Impact Man. I was sort of waiting until all the media buzz died down a bit, and then I thought I would have him on since I've been doing this kind of programming, green programming, since long before mainstream media was interested, and it's fabulous that Colin has gotten the attention of the major networks and has been interviewed by NPR and I'm sure many television stations and many articles written about it. And I also am sort of pleased that I can ask him, you know, now that it's been a while since the experiment ended, what the impact of that is. We're going to get to that before the end of the hour, but first I want to go back, Colin, to you have a chapter called When You See Your Life in the Trash, and then you actually, like many archaeologists would do, and how telling it would be to go through an American landfill to see exactly where your detritus came from, where your debris came from as a family. And one of the things, of course, were many plastic diapers, which make up about 4% of the landfill. I assume you moved to cloth diapers, and you also talk about how plastic bags are, you know, as we know, a big problem. But do they make us happier? Because this is an item, just, you know, two examples of items that are going to last forever, but last how long? Whether it's bringing your food home in a plastic bag, or changing your daughter's diaper, and within a few minutes, which is what always happened with my daughter, it was dirty again. The inherent conflict in just that one item really kind of speaks volumes, doesn't it? How we make things to last forever, even though they're only going to be needed for a couple of minutes in some cases, like coffee cups and plastic water bottles.
Sure. And what you said about the plastic bag that I think is interesting, this question of does it make us happier, you know, because sometimes we environmentalists get accused of being killjoys, right? So you just want to deprive us of everything. You want us to tighten us our belts to the point that, you know, we don't even exist anymore for the sake of this, you know, so-called environment.
It's about sacrifice and deprivation, right?
Right, which is what we get accused of, but actually, you know, I say to a lot of, you know, people say you're into deprivation, and I say, you know, if we look at the way of life, again, back to the economy, people getting kicked out of their homes, people working 10 hours a day so that they don't get time to spend with the people that they care about most, or people who have, you know, are well educated but find themselves in jobs where they don't get to use the parts of themselves that they care about, so they feel prostituted, and in other words, don't have fulfilling lives. I wonder, you know, people say that I'm into deprivation, but I'm wondering whether we're not already deprived. And so the question, like when you say about the plastic bags, does it make us happier, or the, you know, the use of, you know, the incredible use of planetary use resources, does it make us happier? I think that this is a way, you know, another approach to say, look, can't we not change our lives in a way where we make both ourselves happier and the planet happier, which is, you know, this is kind of what happened as the result of our year, you know, trying to live no impact, is that, you know, you mentioned giving up the TV. We gave up the TV and we thought that that would be a hardship. We gave it up because of the electricity use, but it turned out that we spent more time with our family and friends. We started to have these charade parties where people came over, and so we actually socialized more. Or, you know, because we ate local food, we ate food that was actually good for us. And, you know, we lost weight and became healthier, and people actually remarked on how much healthier we looked. And I like to think that our little, you know, experiment where we discovered that living in a way that's happier for the planet was happier for us too is allegorical for the whole culture. So, you know, if we were to able to switch over to renewable energy, yes, that would be better for the planet, but it would also be better for us as a country, because we wouldn't have to be fighting wars to go and get oil, or we wouldn't be burning coal in places where little kids live who are getting asthma. So, you know, it's not about some faraway environment. It's actually about looking, it's gotten to the stage where we're degrading our habitat to the point that it's adversely affecting our own lives. So let's look for a better life for ourselves.
And as you said in the book, we have some sense that we are going against our internal compass. And in other words, we're going against our greater good. And while we have a sense, as Americans especially, a sense of the entitlement and abundance, all that entitlement and abundance in the material sense, and certainly we are a nation of overconsumers when it comes to food, with, what is it, two-thirds of the nation overweight or even obese. We have maxed out. Maybe it just, you know, development and abundance kind of went too far, and now it's time to not necessarily say the party's over, but I think what you're saying and what some of us are discovering is less really is more in terms of satisfaction and slowing down and savoring instead of squandering. Not only our resources, but our lives.
You know, I get lots and lots of emails, and including very surprisingly to me is I get a lot of emails from conservative Republicans, which I didn't expect, because, you know, the whole global warming thing has been politically polarized. I don't believe that it is a Democratic or Republican issue. It's a human issue, and it shouldn't
be. It's a practical issue, not political.
Yeah.
I was on Sean Hannity's show this week trying to explain to them why all the snow piling up on the East Coast was not only not a sign that global warming is a hoax, but actually exactly the kind of climate chaos that climate scientists have been predicting. But
right,
don't get me started on that. Right-wing media.
Right. So. Well, this is really important. I think it's really important to distinguish between right-wing and left-wing media and politicians and the American people, right? Because there are Americans who vote Democrat and Americans who vote Republican. But I've been traveling around the country, and I give talks and have conversations with people around the country. And I talk to plenty of people who, you know, supposedly are from the political party that doesn't believe in global warming. And I say, look, you know, let's just put global warming aside for a minute. You know, those of you in the room who agree with me that something's just not right, raise your hand. And everybody raises their hand because there's a gut feeling that something's not going right. And so I get emails from, you know, conservative Republicans who say to me, look, I'm not even sure I believe in global warming, but I do agree with you that we need to change our priorities, and we need to concentrate on more on things like community and less on things like than stuff. So, you know, it's kind of wonderful in a way that actually we can connect with each other on a human level. And the question is, I think the question is, can we find a way to agree about the solutions instead of arguing about the problems?
Absolutely. And then back to the practicalities, I loved another anecdote where you talk about trying to hunt down a fishnet bag in the Manhattan jungle and how difficult that was. That reminded me, I live in very progressive, supposedly green, you know, Bay Area, Marin County, just north of San Francisco. And about 5 years ago, we were repainting some of the rooms in our home, and I went what I thought would be a quick, you know, jaunt to Home Depot to get some lower no VOC paint. Well, you would have thought I was a Martian, you know, asking for directions based on the looks of the people in the paint department at Home Depot. Now you can get it, but not so long ago, in a place where you would expect it to be plentiful and for people to understand. The guy actually looked at me and he said, why, do you have some kind of allergic or health, you know, problem, health condition? And I said, no, but I don't want to get one either. So that's, and I did a little bit of educating there. Also trying to get just one of those little compost bins, the green plastic bins you put under your sink if you are composting. That was also a very difficult item. You talked about going to Bed Bath & Beyond and the Container Store looking for those bags. I had the same experience, you know, looking for a compost bin. It's a little easier now, but there is a disconnect. I mean, for anyone who wants to try to do the right thing, the green thing, it's not always easy. It certainly, you know, has been made a little bit more accessible, but we have a long way to go, don't we?
Well, I wish I had it handy to read to you. There's this quote by Mahatma Gandhi that I love so much, and it basically says, you know, we can despair about how, you know, how many changes are needed in the world and one thing or another, and it's, you know, it's way in the future and it's never going to happen. But he said, actually, we can make the changes in our own lives and bring the future into the present, more or less. And so, you know, I think there's two things here. I think that the way to move forward are in two ways. One, that we have to actually, if we care about this stuff, then we have to find a way to actually represent that caring in our own lives. Like, our lives and our values have to have integrity. That doesn't mean, again, that we're supposed to deprive ourselves. It's that we're supposed to, if we do, you know, I used to rent an SUV to get around. I didn't have a car, but I would rent SUVs because I thought everybody else is doing it, it doesn't matter. So now, obviously, I don't do that. And so one is, you know, can I find integrity in my personal life and in my community life? And then the next level is how do we get involved in our social systems to actually help cause change in their social systems? And, you know, a lot of us as Americans, you know, complain a lot about what's going on, but we're not actually involved in our democracy. We'll say, well, and then people say, as I did, you know, well, I voted, what do you want from me? But voting is not participation in our democracy.
Or I recycle, what more could I possibly, you know, need to do? And
right.
They think that's the beginning and end of their environmental, you know, behavior.
Right, right. And then, so what I'm saying here is that, you know, we all need to take responsibility, and that sounds onerous. You know, geez, you know, you're telling me I should do this and that, but it's not in my nature. Well, actually, I think that the way forward is actually to figure out what is in our nature. Like, for some of us, to get on the street and to protest is in our nature, and so go do that. But for some of others of us who are more introverted, maybe it's about starting a community garden plot and helping neighbors to get involved. So, in other words, the problem is so big, it requires so many different kinds of solutions, and there's room for all of us. No one of us has to kind of fit in some mold of how somebody else is doing it. Just figure out who we are as people and how we can gift that and how we can use that to help with the problems that we have.
Brilliant. I love you quote Mahatma Gandhi. You also talk a lot in the book about the Menominee tribe, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that you learned about from the great William McDonough's book.
Yes.
And how I love their conflict about when the day you were trying to get a slice of pizza, but because it comes on a paper plate, you deprived yourself. Although I kept wondering, can't you just go in and say, give me the pizza, hold the plate, because I do things like that all the time.
Right.
But maybe you did. I didn't get to the end of the book. But you talked about the guy at the stoplight in his BMW looking smug and probably listening to his, you know, music blasting from his Bose speakers, and you had kind of a Menominee moment where, you know, what am I doing when, you know, the rest of the world is oblivious? And I certainly know that feeling. What came from those kinds of, you know, moments where I'm sure you had many during the course of this year?
You know what I think is really, so the story you're talking about was, you know, I was walking down the street and I was hungry and I looked in a pizza place and I, you know, I love pizza and so I wanted a piece of pizza, but I couldn't have it because it came on a paper plate and it wasn't local, and so I was kind of like feeling like, I just want a piece of pizza, you know. And then
you really wanted a piece of pizza that
day. That day I was just like not in the mood for not being able to do exactly what I wanted, and I got to the intersection and it was a red light, and there was this convertible BMW stopped blasting its stereo, and this guy sitting there looking all happy, and every pretty girl in the city seemed to be like staring at him, and I was like, and I can't even have a piece of pizza.
He's the master of the universe, and you're just trying to get a slice of pizza.
Yeah, right. But I think that the lesson in that is, like, not that everybody else, like the guy in the BMW is oblivious. I think the real lesson is that I looked at the guy in the BMW and I was angry at him. And I wasn't angry at him because he's bad. I was angry at him because I had unfulfilled desires and I wanted what he had. right? And so this is really interesting, I think, because what it tells me is, like, a lot of the times when I'm angry at people who so-called don't act environmentally, it's because really what I'm doing is I'm projecting on them my own, you know, geez, I want to drive, you know, I'm repressing the fact that I want a BMW too, you know, and I want it, you know, I just want the pizza when I want it, and I'm repressing that. And so what I can't stand is that I see in them what I have in myself. And so the real lesson, I think, is to actually recognize, oh, I even have these desires myself. So if they're bad, I'm bad. Or maybe neither of us bad. Maybe both of us are the same. And therefore, I can have compassion for them and understand, oh, you have so much desire for these things, even though it's bad for the planet. I have those desires too, you know. And now that I recognize that, I can deal compassionately with you and approach you and change your mind with love instead of anger. Because, you know, we so often, I think, try to change people's minds about these things. Like, just think about, like, when you go to the dining table with your family and you start to have an argument, do you change anybody's mind when you shout at them? No, you don't. But if you can say to them, look, I noticed this about you and your life, and I'm saying this with love, I think you'll be happier if you just do this, and blah, 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 and you approach people with love, you can change people's minds. So I think, you know, those kind of incidents are really good for us to recognize that we are just like the people whose minds we wish we could change.
And so much wisdom in this experience, in this book, in your writing. But in the end, because the system that we are all part of does create so much, you know, what seems to be inevitable waste, and because of the rapid rate at which we're seeing, you know, ecological decline on so many fronts, do you really have hope that we can turn this around in time for your daughter and my 16-year-old daughter and their children to live a life of abundance and to thrive in the way that we grew up with, kind of taking for granted?
I always say, you know, I give a lot of talks, and people ask me, like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? You know, do you have hope? And you know, is it all going to be okay? People always say, is it all going to be okay?
You're the prophet now.
Yeah, well, no, it's not that I'm a prophet. It's that, you know, universally people have, you know, I just want to know that it's going to be okay. And that's it's a troubling question, because what they're really looking for is for the tension to be relieved within themselves. Tell me it will be okay so I can stop worrying. But the way to stop worrying is not to believe that it's okay, to put your head in the sand. The way to stop worrying is to begin to take action. To begin to say to yourself, you know, I don't know whether it's going to be okay. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to fix everything. I don't know if I make a difference. But it turns out that for me, when I'm worried about things, I feel better if I actually try to do something about them. And so in my own small way, I'm going to do that.
And that's brilliant, because when I talk to people too sometimes about, you know, they say, well, what's the one thing I can do, you know, to green my life? And I used to really struggle with that, because there are, of course, so many things: what we eat, what we drive, how we build, how we use energy in our homes and offices, what we do in our communities to, you know, sort of spread the green gospel. And it's a tough one. So I just started saying, because I realized, well, gosh, if everyone just had this, you know, consciousness, the sensitivity that some of us, again, for better and worse, seem to be born with or develop at a pretty early age, being super conscientious about use of resources. And I said, put on the green glasses and just get, from the time you wake up and you get in the shower, the toilet you flush, the kind of coffee you brew, organic fair trade or whatever you can afford, you know, local produce, just look for ways. Make it fun. Make it like when you're on a diet and you're trying to find flavorful, low-fat foods, you know. And that's the best thing you can do, is look around and make it a game and see what you can do. And you can instantly go from being part of the problem to part of the solution, that it doesn't take a massive effort or even reading books and seeing lots of documentaries, you know, although that's certainly a good thing to do. But, you know, it really can happen that quickly once you make that shift in your consciousness, don't you think?
Well, and
another
thing,
it grows from there. Once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back, right?
Right. And another thing that I would add to that is that, you know, it's hard to make changes in your life all by yourself. So seeking out a community of people who share your values, who may be a little bit further along the path from you, that you can learn from, and who also don't, you know, call you stupid for trying. You know, that happened to me a lot, right? During the No Impact Year, people said, are you too stupid to realize that you can't make a difference? And finally I was like, yeah, I'm too stupid. I'm too stupid to realize.
I like that, because I get a lot, people say, it seems like, you know, I'm generalizing a little bit here, but people tend to fall into two camps. One problem, what problem? And that's mostly the folks on Fox News and perhaps other pockets. But then the other half is like, well, yeah, of course we're doomed, Betsy. I know that, don't you? I mean, like, how can you be so naive? And so they're not doing anything because it's pointless. And, you know, trying to find that sweet spot in the middle where we can really make changes that will make a difference.
Well, all of that happens when we get in our heads, when we get too much in our heads and we read the scientific information about this and the scientific information about that. But, you know, if we come across somebody, say a child in the street who's injured, we don't ask ourselves what are the chance, you know, first of all, we don't get in an argument over whether there's a problem or not. And second of all, we don't argue over whether we can help the kid or not, whether our efforts will work. We just start helping. And so if we get out of our heads and just move down into our hearts, into our guts, into our souls, if you believe in that, and just say, you know, what's the correct response to the situation? It's just to help. You know, and I should mention, you know, something really interesting. We have this, I mentioned my nonprofit, which is at noimpactproject.org, and we have this program called No Impact Week. And in No Impact Week, basically, people did what we did, try to live in it as environmentally as possible for a week instead of a year, and there's a whole program. And just at this very moment, as we speak, we're doing a No Impact Week in partnership with Yes Magazine, which I think is at yesmag.org, and there's 2,000 people. At this moment, 2,000 people are trying to live as environmentally as possible doing No Impact Week, and they're all blogging about it and writing about it on at the Yes Magazine website. So it's not too late to join in. Anybody who's interested can join in, and in that way, you're actually joining a community of people who are, you know, giving it a try.
I love that. So I am topical and timely even after taking this long to get you on my show. And speaking of that, kind of coincidental to this interview, we unplugged the TV set yesterday, or my husband hasn't actually physically done it, but we're acting as if it's unplugged because we were having so many battles with our 16-year-old daughter. She, you know, said she needs the TV on in the background to do her homework because our house can be too quiet because she's an only child pretty much. And our dog only makes so much commotion, and sometimes after dinner, you know, I'm on my computer downstairs and my husband's on his, you know, at the dining room table. My daughter's in her room, and so she has to have the TV on. And she's gotten into, your wife used to watch the Bridezilla reality shows. My daughter, you know, watches Real Housewives of Atlanta and D.C. and Beverly Hills, which is exactly, you know, talk about grating against my soul. It's everything I despise, materialism, you know, ridiculous feigned arguments over, you know, real garbage. And so I just finally said, cold turkey, we got to stop it. And sure enough, last night it was quiet. We were going to start putting music on instead, but it was a little bit uncomfortable for the first few minutes as I was making dinner and Larry King was not in the background. And you know what? I have to ask my daughter today, but I think she actually got more homework done. And, you know, we survived. And you go from there. So this may become a regular thing. And I'm kind of a news junkie, having been in radio news before I took a green turn. But you know what? The benefit, it's about the benefits, isn't it, really, Colin? Isn't it about the surprise, silver lining or green lining in doing some of these things that we think we're addicted to and think we need?
Well, I mean, I think ultimately we're at a point in history where we need to ask, how do we want to live? And you know, what are we for? Like, what are our lives for? Why are we alive? And those you know, sometimes get dismissed as overly philosophical questions. But the thing is, we're at the stage where now you can work, you can be born, work, live, and die just having, you know, worked your rear end off. And maybe not really having had the love and the community and the leisure time that you wanted. And it's all about earning enough money to buy a pair of jet skis, which then stay in the garage for all but 1 week a year. And that's, it may not be good for us, and it's certainly not good for the environment. So we have this incredible opportunity to ask ourselves to stop and say, how should we live, both individually as families and also as a culture? Like, what would actually be best for us? How do we want to live? And so there's a tremendous opportunity in this, too.
Absolutely. And so are you now a minimal impact man? I assume you've gone back to having some environmental impact, but given what you did for that year, probably nothing is mindless and everything is pretty conscientious.
So much of what we did was good for us. So, for example, we got our exercise because, you know, and here in New York City, people take a taxi to the gym so that they can then get on a treadmill and run in place, for example.
And use electricity in the meantime,
right,
doing the treadmill.
Well, we discovered we could get our exercise by biking around. And it turns out that studies show that bikers are the happiest of all commuters. So, or similarly, you know, we don't have to worry about the perils of genetically modified food or whatnot, because it turns out that the local farmers who bring the food to our farmers market actually care about what goes into my little girl's body. And so by eating local food, we are eating food that we know is good for us. Or, you know, we save $2,000 a year. We do have electricity back on, but we gave away our air conditioner, so we save $2,000 a year. Or similarly, by buying secondhand, we save a lot of money. And so there's lots that was just better for us. You know, we still don't have a TV because we preferred to talk to each other and our friends.
And so your daughter's going to be raised without Sesame Street. Do you think she'll be okay? And what about your wife, Michelle, the fashionista before this experiment? Has she changed her buying habits as far as clothing and girly stuff?
Yeah, well, you know, she her hobby was shopping more or less. And so it was her, you know, it was her that had us get rid of the television sooner than we would have. And her that decided that she wasn't, the rule of the project was not buying anything new, but she decided she wouldn't buy anything at all because she felt she had, as in her words, she was addicted to shopping. And, you know, she had.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, right. So, but, you know, she's just decided, you know, it also means that we were living from paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, we don't want to live that way anymore. She doesn't want to live that way anymore.
And just before we close, you know, you talk in your book about how your grandparents talked about the days of the rag and bone man, where someone would come around and take all the, you know, unused scraps, things like, I think you said bones to make buttons and oil to make certain products, and the unused clothing or used clothing that would have been trashed today in a minute. New York Minute got used to make some kind of textiles. Think how far we've come from those days. But we'd like to think the American dream is going from rags to riches. Maybe we should not quite go back to rags, but really reexamine what we consider to be our riches.
I mean, in some ways, we're in terms of that kind of the reuse scenario that you're talking about, where buttons were made from discarded bones and paper was made from discarded cloth and all this type of thing. In some ways, we're not going to have too much of a choice about returning to that anyway, because the reason why we're able to have everything new is because energy is so cheap and available, and we can just extract the resources. What changed us from that kind of reuse scenario to the everything new scenario that we have now is the availability of petroleum. And like it or not, petroleum is running out. You know, global warming aside, you know, the United States Army says we have something like 30 years left of oil, and then we're done. And so at that stage, we're going to have to be returning to the low, less intensive, energy intensive ways of life, which includes reuse, living local, you know, rebuilding our communities, this type of thing.
So No Impact Man is going to become the Bible for all of us, perhaps. And just to wrap up, I think the ultimate insight is, you know, people tend to see this as, you know, selfishness versus altruism. I think as soon as we start realizing that it is in our own selfish interest, and certainly our children's and grandchildren's and beyond, to start looking at living a more sustainable lifestyle across the board. So thank you for what you've done, a true trailblazer, an eco-pioneer of the first degree. You're one of my heroes, and I really am proud to know you through this interview, and we'll follow up with you and see where we go from here.
Well, thank you for your hard work over these many years trying to bring us all the message.
You know, it can be a little bit lonely out here in the green wilderness, but hopefully we'll have a lot of friends joining us real soon as people wake up and smell the CO2 and also learn the benefits of living a simpler lifestyle. It's not about deprivation. It's about divine gratitude. And thank you again for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Been talking with Colin Bevan, No Impact Man. I want to wish you a great green week. We're just about out of time. If you'd like to hear the entire interview with Colin, I highly recommend it, as well as his book and documentary of the same name. Go to my website, and that is thegreenfront.com. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Tell your friends about The Green Front. It's news you can use.